Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger and I'm joined today by Andrew Forsch and Alec Rich. Andrew, Alec, how are you both doing?
Hey, yeah, very well. Happy to be here as always.
Yeah, nice to be back.
And listener, you would have noticed something here. There's no Ian Wenig. So for those of you who tuned in for Ian, look, tune out, I guess. It's not the best way to start a podcast, but you know, if that's what you came for, and I know that his wife and mother are two of our biggest listeners, I'm really sorry. But Ian is, as we record, on his way to Boston to gather a bunch more scoops. So it's all in aid of furthering the great mission of Citywire RAA. But sadly, yeah, this is the first podcast that he's missed. He did propose recording at 6 a.m. this morning so that he could still make it and travel. But
not an attractive prospect for this new father.
Yeah, for one new father, for one older father, and for one person who just doesn't want to get up and record a podcast at 6 in the morning, Alec, which
exactly.
I think is fair enough.
Yeah, but, let the record show that he did try to maintain his perfect streak. So
He did. And I maybe in the future, this podcast won't be included in the canon. This won't count. This will be like that period of Saturday Night Live when Lorne Michaels wasn't there or something.
It's more of an exhibition. This won't affect the professional
record. Yeah. This doesn't count to professional records. Anyway, it actually does. It's going to be a really good podcast. We've got some really great stories to talk about. And we've got some really great people to talk about them. And Andrew, I think we'll start with what is, you know, without doubt, frankly, the biggest story in RAA land and all of wealth management this week, which is this massive breakaway, or I suppose proposed breakaway, from Merrill Lynch to form its own RAA, but with backing from Dynasty and indeed quite a lot of assistance from Schwab too. So the size of the firm involved is, I think we're using the figure $129 billion. In assets under management / advice. Is that correct?
Loosely correct. Yeah, this is what Barron's has identified from this team. So what has happened is, this is a really large coup for Dynasty if they can pull it off. Obviously, this is still kind of an attempted breakaway more than it is a finalized one, but the team is from Merrill Lynch down in Georgia, in the Atlanta area. This is the global corporate and institutional advisory services business. This was a very large team focused on serving institutions. They had a mix of kind of corporate retirement plans that they manage, as well as corporate kind of stock compensation plans. But they also had a very robust, private client kind of traditional wealth management business, which Sheryl Penny pegged at about, that's Dynasty's chief executive, pegged at about $25 billion. A huge coup, and they are going independent, or at least they're trying to. Of course, Merrill has taken issue with this. They're not about to, let one of their largest, highest producing teams go out the door without a fight. So they have filed suit
Let's get into the suit in a minute. So let's just to recap. So the firm, or I suppose the team, what was a team and is going to be a firm, is about 50 advisors, as you said, about $25 billion per Sheryl Penny in terms of sort of, pure wealth management assets, and another sort of $100 billion or so in retirement plan assets. And it's going to be called Open Arc Corporate Advisory.
That's correct. Open Arc, I believe, referring to open architecture, although how exactly that fits in, I'm not entirely certain.
I'm guessing the implication is in the Merrill world, it's closed architecture, and in the independent world, it's open, and there's a greater array of products and providers and things you can use for either the retirement plan part of the business,
sure,
or the wealth part of the business.
Sounds good.
I guess. I don't know. Look, I'm also not sure how much that, is a pull for clients, but this the point of this pod is not our opinion on names, although that would be a good episode, I'm sure. Okay, but prior to that iteration, when it was at Merrill, it was part of the Global Corporate and Institutional Advisory Services business. And this is, can we say this was probably one of its largest teams and the whole of Merrill? Before we get into the lawsuit, because the lawsuit's really, really interesting and key to the story, just sort of the size of the scope of this team, both in what it was for Merrill and what it would be outside of Merrill.
Yeah, so in Merrill, I think we are fair to say that. In Merrill's lawsuit, they refer to this team as the largest of its specialty practice groups. And so, yes, you mentioned about 50 advisors there. While at Merrill, they pegged it at about 90 advisors plus another 80, staffers, client service people, administrative folks. I believe 50 advisors is the number that Sheryl has tipped for how many advisors that they've brought over. Of course, that's not an exact figure. Could be a little more, could be a little less. But yes, it is one of the biggest teams, if not the biggest team at Merrill, and one of the biggest kind of individual teams of advisors really anywhere in the industry across any wirehouse that I'm aware of.
And do we had an idea, I think, somewhere about how much revenue it did and sort of how that
more than $100 million annually. One of the very few. I mean, you can count on one hand the number of individual teams doing that much production on an annual basis. So these guys are definitely the real deal.
And we've alluded to this a little bit, but it's not just your standard wealth management practice. So obviously, a lot of the assets, slightly lower margin assets, but a huge amount of them are sort of in retirement plan and kind of corporate stock management. Is that correct? So talk me through that a little bit, because that's obviously not something that every RIA has as part of their business.
Yeah, it's more of an assets under advisement model. So they manage corporate retirement plans, 401ks, that sort of thing, as well as stock compensation plans. And they do planning for the participants in those plans as well. That business comprises about $100 billion in assets under administration for them. But really the value is in the pipeline there. So say you have a corporate executive who is exercising stock options, then they have a massive windfall, and the idea is the pipeline directs them to get advisory services, traditional wealth management, financial planning from the advisors on this team as well. So it's a huge kind of funnel into that higher margin wealth business.
Yeah, okay, got it. And obviously still a big business in and of itself. And what's really interesting, I suppose, and this might take us into the lawsuit, is that Merrill is effectively arguing that those initial clients, those corporate clients, sort of Merrill got, or Merrill Bank of America got those and passed them on to this practice. So that's sort of one of the reasons, among many, why it's particularly reluctant to let this business go without a fight. So let's get into that a little bit. So this deal was announced, or was going to be announced, on Wednesday by Dynasty and Co. But on Tuesday night, Merrill dropped the lawsuit.
Yeah, they're claiming, this is a premeditated corporate raid. So the same day, basically a bunch of advisors resigned en masse on Tuesday. By Tuesday afternoon, Merrill had a, 50-page lawsuit filed in federal court in Georgia. They have taken issue with basically the procedures and the methodology that these advisors have taken in setting up their own RIA, recruiting other members of the team to go join them, soliciting clients as well, which they claim the advisors have done in breach of their contracts. But yes, you're correct to identify, like, an interesting point here is a claim from Merrill that these advisors were not generating their own client leads. Corporations and very large employers will choose a big brand name Wall Street firm, bank, wirehouse to manage their retirement plans. That's one of the benefits of having a brand like Merrill. So they are arguing that these advisors, have a weaker claim of ownership over the client relationships, given that they did not generate those client relationships themselves. A lot of them were passed down from, institutional clients that were already working with Merrill, and then referrals in from other segments of the company. So it's kind of the same approach that Edelman Financial Engines has taken in a lot of its lawsuits against departing advisors.
I suppose they have that similar model to this particular part of Merrill, which is they are, Edelman,
correct,
obviously a big part
retirement
of this business.
Funneling
is that retirement
into
plan, corporate advice on stock plans, etc. So it's that kind of, you know, your clients really came through these relationships that we had at a firm level. So a similar argument. I mean, obviously, we've only seen Merrill's side of the lawsuit, and the first part of a lawsuit that's filed is always kind of, you know, it's unanswered, and it's always going to paint people in a particularly bad light. With that said, obviously, it makes for great reading, it makes for great copy. And so just sort of to be irresponsible for a moment, are there any sort of particularly salacious details that Merrill has alleged in that people might want to be aware of?
Yeah, I'll talk through a few of them. I will say there are all kinds of details mentioned in the lawsuit that have not been filed yet as exhibits. So we'll see. You know, I'm not a lawyer, and a plaintiff can kind of accuse anybody of doing anything. So take all this with a grain of salt, and we'll see what else crops up in the court register later through future filings, depositions, discovery, that kind of thing. One of the big issues is, Merrill has accused the leaders of this group of violating their contracts by setting up the RIA entity while they were still employed at Merrill, and wrongly soliciting advisors and other staffers to join them, including by holding kind of recruiting meetings in Merrill's own offices, and also at, employees' homes. There were promises of equity in the new RIA entity, so Merrill has taken issue with that and is claiming that these advisors have breached their contracts. Now, it's kind of a tricky legal battle because you are allowed to prepare to compete, but the specific terms of your contracts might determine what behaviors are prohibited, what behaviors are allowed, and so the details of that will be parsed out by the courts and indeed maybe by the SEC. This is a big enough team and a big enough break that I could see federal regulators potentially taking an eye to this.
I guess that's a question, and this is the kind of question where I worry that we don't all know the answer, but I'm going to try and ask it anyway, which is sort of obviously the sheer volume of assets here is different, and is to some degree sort of quote unquote game changing. But the fundamentals of a team leaving a wirehouse to go independent with support from a third party, be it a dynasty or be it, many others, perhaps with slightly different models and some sort of relationship with a custodian they're going to use. I mean, that's a story that's played out on an almost weekly basis. And, yes, everyone has contracts. Everyone has, as you say, it could depend on the contract, but some degree of non-compete, non-solicitation, etc. And yet these things happen all the time. And for the most part, they are unchallenged. I mean, they might be challenged a bit more than we're aware of. And it might be that you say a $3 billion team leaves and actually that team ends up being about a $2 billion team because of what everyone's sort of okay with happening. So I guess what I'm driving to here is, not so much why is Merrill suing. I think we can all see why that is, and there's 129 billion reasons. But what's different about this, maybe compared to others, or is it just a size thing?
Yeah, I think it's size and scale. I think the involvement of Dynasty and of Charles Schwab, which we haven't even really unpacked that angle to this. So Schwab is going to be the custodian there. But again, the idea is that Schwab will funnel some of its own, retirement plan participants and clients on the retirement side of its business into this team. Schwab is named as a defendant to this lawsuit. Dynasty is named as a defendant to this lawsuit. And so Merrill, obviously is a signatory to the broker protocol, which endeavors to limit this very sort of litigation, because if
Merrill
that didn't
and
exist,
Dynasty also a signatory to that.
Dynasty also a signatory. Yeah. So one of the issues at hand here is Merrill says, we have these corporate trade secrets and this proprietary client information stemming from the relationships that we have with our corporate institutional clients. And so what they are really taking issue with is not, okay, they're taking the wealth business, which is still a big coup in its own right, but they're upset. They want these relationships and this information classified as proprietary trade secrets. And the argument is that because Schwab is not a signatory to the broker protocol, and because the advisors in question here are not actually joining Dynasty, that is a big violation, that these advisors have shared that alleged trade secrets and alleged proprietary information with those two external firms. If that makes any kind of sense, hopefully it does.
I think it does, yeah. And I suppose last sort of thing on this then is, how big a deal is it? I mean, obviously, look, again, we've discussed the scale and the size, but this does seem, to your point about Schwab and its involvement and Dynasty, somewhat transformative is probably too big a word with regards to Schwab. That's already a very big business, but certainly for Dynasty, I mean, Dynasty's 100 and something billion total between the 50 odd firms that it currently has affiliated with it. And, you know, even if you just count the wealth assets, in terms of this, that's still another 25 on top of that, which is, you know, hugely meaningful for it as a business. Dynasty's taking a stake in this new business, OpenArc. And as you alluded to as well, obviously Schwab even, there's going to be some sort of tie up there with it and its own sort of retirement and stock planning, businesses too. So it's clearly sort of meaningfully additive for Schwab. You know, it's more than just a large RAA. You know, team breaking away, forming a large AA and using Schwab as a custodian, that there's more going on here, more sort of synergies, more sort of, you know, future business that can be written as a result of this. So overall sort of, yeah, if this happens, a massive deal for RAA land as a whole, I'm going to ask you to speculate here. How much do we think it will happen? What does it look like? You know, put your lawyer's hat on, put your clairvoyant hat on. What do you think this sort of nets out at the end of the day? Because it's unlikely that it's not going to happen. Merrill can't literally stop it, but I guess it could stop some things from happening, perhaps.
Well, I think the first element to unpack is even if these guys end up taking a meaningful percentage of the corporate retirement plan business, that's going to take a very, very long time. Those decisions, if you're going to change the management of that kind of plan, these companies, these employers have to vote on that. It will take months and years for those assets to move. It's also a relatively difficult pitch to go to a Fortune 1000 company and say, hey, we want you to move your entire stock compensation plan, your entire 401k plan to a company that was formed this year called OpenArc Corporate Advisory out of Merrill Lynch. So I just don't see that happening for every one of these institutional clients.
I will say, I mean, you know, take it with a grain or indeed bucket of salt, but in the release that came out on this, I did see some of the OpenArc founders, sort of ex-team members at Merrill, saying, and I think this is the Dynasty message too, that, you know, this is what clients want. You know, clients had asked for more from their thing. So I take your point. I suppose the counter would be their argument is it is in fact client-led, and this is better for clients, and clients have indeed asked for it.
Look, there's a push for independent advice. Yeah, I mean, this has been probably, you know, up there with consolidation, the driving story of this business over the last decade. There is a massive demand for independent, unbiased fiduciary advice, and so this is maybe the single largest, single example of that movement happening in recent memory. I just think it'll take a lot of time. They're almost certainly not going to get all of the corporate retirement plan assets. Merrill has that brand and that reputation for a reason. Some of those institutional clients will opt to stay with Merrill, and that business as well is less relationship based than the kind of traditional wealth management business. It's less fundamentally tied to the relationship between the advisor and the client.
I suppose very quickly and last thing on this, because I'm conscious we've got Alec here waiting to weigh in on a whole other story. But yeah, last thing I was going to say is just coming back to the size of this, I suppose, you know, we haven't seen really anything like this, certainly that I can ever remember reporting on. And I guess if it does go through or even go through 70, 80%, what have you, does this set a new precedent? Does this sort of, you know, anyone else in the RIA ecosystem who thinks, actually, come on, you know, hang on a second, can we pull out a large team from a wirehouse? Suddenly the sort of threshold for what a large team might be raises significantly. You know, and we know there's all sorts of people who are willing and able and well-funded to sort of set up RIA businesses. You know, suddenly is any wirehouse team game now for a breakaway if this can be done?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, just seeing, I mean, even if they just get the wealth assets, it's a huge coup. You know, 20, 25 billion, it's a huge deal. And yes, it would signal to the market that, hey, it doesn't matter how big you are, it doesn't matter how much revenue you're doing for a wirehouse, this is possible. And there's something on the other side where you can kind of own the upside in this business. And you can kind of position yourself as the main beneficiary for an eventual exit. And so that's what these guys have done. They've got the equity portion now. I mean, they could have left for a different wirehouse or an IBD and gotten a 9-figure check, right? But instead they're cutting a check of their own, in order to own this business. So, it's a meaningful story. And, you can bet the wirehouses will be watching. I will say, if Merrill's claim does come to fruition and this is seen as a corporate raid, that's going to be a big penalty for these guys. UBS has won a case in the recent past. There have been some others, and the payouts ordered by the SEC are large. So this is not without risk.
Excellent. Well, look, from our point of view, you know, it's a story that's going to run. So, something to keep an eye on. And listener, the best place to put those eyes, citywire.com/RIA. Now let's pivot quickly. Let's pivot from someone starting an RIA to someone ending an RIA, which is not something you see every day. So Alec, you've patiently sat there and listened to all things Dynasty, Merrill and Schwab for the last 20 or so minutes. But you got a great scoop actually towards the end of last week, but more on it this week about Strive, which is an interesting firm because it was set up by Vivek Ramaswamy, if I've pronounced that correctly. I think originally he started a sort of a fund management division, which was kind of an anti-ESG sort of shop doing index funds, but specifically ones that didn't take any stance on ESG anyway, I've butchered how I've said that, but anyway, that's what he started out as. But he then pivoted to launch a wealth management business, and there's a sort of Bitcoin element to all this, but the wealth management business is no more. So look, I'm going to stop garbling this and pass it over to you to explain what's happened and why.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, this has been developing essentially over the course of a little bit less than a year now. You know, we covered the launch of this. It was called Strive Wealth Management last November, and you know, it was received a lot of fanfare at the time. You know, obviously because of Ramaswamy's founding of it, but also of some of the larger backers of it. You know, the Strive had the larger parent company had raised $30 million in summer of 2024.
Yeah, who was it? Were Ackman and Peter Thiel involved?
Yeah, Peter
Have
Thiel.
I got those two names right? I'm not sure.
The venture capital firm founded by, you know, now Vice President J.D. Vance and some others, Cantor Fitzgerald also contributed. So it was all put toward propping up this RIA, or at least, you know, a share of it was. And, you know, we had this more recent reporting, you know, on my end kind of started a couple of months ago. We kind of received a note from someone about the fact that, you know, Strive was moving to, you know, potentially wind down the operations of its RIA, but we couldn't substantiate it at the time. So this really came about because Strive Incorporated, which is the parent company of Strive Wealth Management is a publicly traded firm. They had to file public filings about that. And there was a letter to shareholders published in the late August, essentially noting because of an internal merger taking place at the company and kind of this full sale pivot by Strive toward accumulating Bitcoin assets, essentially, and that becoming the focus of the company, that they had to, quote, wind down. And also they used the word divest from the wealth, this 179 million AUM wealth management arm. And so that reporting kind of emerged from that.
That's really interesting. I mean, and we'll come on to the sort of the Bitcoin business in a moment, but I mean, that's 179, you said, it's not bad work. I mean, I don't know where the money came from. I don't know, who the clients were. You know, obviously it's got some very rich backers and founders, whether it's just their money, whether it had, you know, organically raised that. It's obviously a very, you know, some really well-connected people involved in it who no doubt could put them in touch with some wealthy clients pretty quickly. But, you know, it's not a bad start to a business. So it does seem, a strange step perhaps to throw in the towel at this stage. But I guess what it's more about, it not fitting in with a broader corporate strategy than that business not working.
But I mean, also the company did acknowledge in that shareholder letter that the RA was such a small portion of its overall operations, that it, you know, wasn't really necessary to maintain. You know, they had brought in, you know, a couple of names to run that RIA, the most prominent being the president of it was a former executive at, you know, Beacon Point, Gary K. Dorfman. You know, I put it to Strive specifically whether he was still employed with them, and they, you know, did not disclose whether that's the case. So you have all that in play, and you would think that it would be able to sustain this kind of enterprise, but you know, they're, you know, essentially moving to move away. They're moving away from it now.
And so, what do they have left? So again, the sort of the anti-ESG, or I think they sort of prefer the term sort of pro-capitalist or something, sort of asset management arm, which I believe is over $2 billion in assets. It got a lot of publicity when it started. I think assets commensurately with that. Maybe that's slowed a little bit, but, you know, it's only been around for a couple of years, maybe three. It's got $2 billion. That's not to be sniffed at. So that business, as far as we understand, still exists. And then there's this Bitcoin business too.
So I think the Bitcoin business is essentially what the company is aiming at now. You know, Strive Asset Management, which is what you were referring to, is kind of still a subsidiary of Strive, but Strive Incorporated as a whole, it just last week kind of created this whole new board of directors. They, you know, completed a equity financing of, you know, over, you know, $1 billion, and they're essentially going all in on Bitcoin accumulation and strategic decision making and, you know, fiduciary duty, as they say, kind of around increasing Bitcoin per share for their shareholders. So they're trying to become the first Bitcoin treasury company, as they put it. So that's really the main focus.
And so Bitcoin treasury companies are effectively publicly listed companies that then use money to go and buy Bitcoin, sort of like MicroStrategy, or I think it's now called Strategy, Michael Saylor's companies. He sort of, have I got his name right? I'm going to check while you talk. But they're the sort of poster child for this sort of strategy, right? Which is sort of be a publicly listed company, but effectively be a proxy for Bitcoin, be a sort of Bitcoin reserve. So that's the Strive model to some degree.
Right. Yep. That's my understanding. And, you know, you have folks from, you know, both who were kind of at Strive previously and, you know, folks who were kind of in Ramaswamy's orbit as well. You know, the new CFO of, or you know, the CFO of this new entity, Strive Incorporated, that was formed by this merger, Ben Pham was formerly Ramaswamy's chief of staff. So you kind of have this, crisscross of politics and finance, you know, at the top of this company now. And it should also note that Ramaswamy himself is not, you know, involved in terms of the leadership anymore, but he does hold, I think, 142 million shares of common stock in the company, as we, you know, reported last week. So he is, you know, heavily kind of financially involved, both personally and through an irrevocable trust in this company.
And just to bring it back to the wealth management arm, because that's sort of our interest here, you know, we're not, deeply focused on Bitcoin or strategies around that. But in terms of the wealth management, so what happens now? So it winds down. You alluded to maybe the people who are involved in that part of the business, obviously may or may not be there anymore. client assets? Do they, are they referring them to someone else? I mean, we may not know any answers of this, but just given this is something that you don't see very often, I'm just interested to know how one goes about this maneuver. Yeah.
So frankly, at this point, it's still a bit unclear. You know, they really have not given us much clarity when we've reached out to them. Pretty much what we have to work off of is the documents. So, I mean, as a condition of that merger, you know, they did have to wind it down in some capacity. Whether they're going to attempt to spin it off, you know, or not, still kind of remains to be seen. We, you know, just a couple of days ago, they released a Form 8K kind of financial position of the company, and it noted that, you know, the separation expenses related to Stripe Wealth Management were over $6 million, and Stripe Wealth Management itself had accumulated a deficit of $3 million. So that kind of gives us further insight into, you know, the financial conditions of that company, whether it's going to, you know, persist in some other capacity or not. You know, I should note, when I did reach out to Stripe for comment, they did say that for now, Stripe Wealth Management is, you know, an existing RIA. But if you go on Stripe's website and try to search for it or any of the, you know, leaders of it, you know, you can no longer find them on the site.
Interesting. Well, again, another one to keep an eye on. Look, fantastic stuff. I think, you know, we have more than covered for Ian's absence here. But I, you know, I would never say that to his face. But look, thank you both very much indeed for your time. I think very much before we go in tradition of this podcast, we should talk about films or indeed baseball. And Alec, the Mets, my man, what's happening?
Yeah, so, I mean, so, I think I speak for all Mets fans when I say that we're not having a good time right now.
As we speak, there's a one game margin, right?
There is
the playoffs,
a one game margin.
By one game.
That's correct. I mean, the Mets, if you know anything about them, are going to make it as stressful as possible for everyone involved. So they'll probably either make or not make the playoffs by a coin flip at this point. Remains to be seen. But, you know, that's causing much stress for myself after work many days.
Well, look, I think the simple solution is focus on work here. You know, don't watch the Mets. Just get into those Strive documents, see what you can find.
That's what I always say.
Meanwhile, my hometown team, the Seattle Mariners, has clinched. They've got a catcher who hits 60 home runs. I think Vegas has them as the favorite to win the World Series. They've never been to a World Series. It's amazing.
Must be nice.
Oh, and you're swinging, and all of a sudden now the team's doing well. Literally never heard you mention baseball before. Fair
Go Mariners,
play.
Baby.
That's how, yeah. Credit where it's due.
It's about the right time to jump on the bandwagon, right?
Yeah,
buy high, I think, is what generally is advised. So, yeah.
Oh, 100%. Definitely. Yeah, that's pretty much how everyone does invest. So, yeah. Excellent. Well, look, on that note, thank you both very much indeed. We will be back for another episode very soon of This Week in Wealth. But for the time being, goodbye.